Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Sensei Marco Van Etten for part two of their discussion on martial arts, spirituality, and the growing influence of women. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization. In our last conversation with Henry and Margo, Kathleen Fitzpatrick wanted to take a deeper dive into a question that Margo was asked about the nature of the sword. Here is their discussion about the relationship between a practitioner and her sword.
Kathleen has a question or a comment.
I wanted to draw you out a little bit more, Margo, on the nature of this sword. We practice, and I practice, both of these sword arts that were taught in our school. Kenjutsu, which is the fighting art with which we use a wooden sword, and those we hit on each other. And Kenai, where we use the sharp sword. And I happen to own both a sharp sword and a non-sharp ornamental sword. When Elaine asked you about the symbolism of the sword, it caused me to think about my relationship with my sharp sword, which you had blessed for me in the ceremony that you mentioned. I wanted to draw you out a little bit more on the really deep relationship between the practitioner and her sword.
When I started with the live sword, we spent a couple of classes where we did what looked like nothing but sit with our sword. And again, the sword, on the one hand, an extension of yourself. So there is an active relationship with the sword. And on the other hand, it is a means for cutting through the ego, the false ego. My sword was an actual Japanese blade. It was a gendaito. It was a sword that was surrendered at the end of World War II by its owner. So it's a signed blade. And it was made in the traditional way. So there are, you can see the pattern of the steel. You can see there's a mark called a heiman on the edge where it was quenched. You know, after when they pound it and they fold it and pound it, the technique, the physical technique is sort of like making strudel. You fold over, you pound down, you fold over, different kinds of iron and steel are fused together. And then it has to be quenched and then sharpened and all of that. And that produces this wave-like pattern, the grain and everything. So you become very aware of that and very aware of the sword. And you treat it specially. When you're cleaning your blade, you don't just dunk some steel cleaner on it and polish it off. There's a whole ritual you go through, which ideally is as mindful as anything else, where you're taking it out. You have a little thing that looks like a ball with a stick on it, which has chalk in it, and you do that, and then you polish it, you oil it, you put it back very mindfully. It's really difficult to describe. It's almost entering into it intuitively and imaginally, not imaginatively, to build that relationship so that when you have the sword, as soon as you have put the sword on, you are already in that state because you've done these other practices. And so it's like walking into a zendo or into a shrine room. You've done enough practice that when you're there, you're already beginning to be in the space. Does that come close to what you were thinking of, Kathleen?
It does. I think I'd like to take a chance here and go a step further. In karate, we have weapons. So we have a bow, which is a staff, and our sai, and tanfa, and maybe a few other nunchaku. I never really liked the nunchaku. I always hurt myself with them. But nothing that I've ever worked with had a consciousness the way my sharp sword does.
Yeah, there's a sense, and again, this comes right out of the older traditions, that the sword is, in some sense, aware. That doesn't mean you can say, okay, sword, now show me how to do this. But the sword teaches you. If it's balanced right and if it's made right, the sword has its own balance and movement as you're using it. You're not making it cut. It will cut. I had started out with a sword that had been made, I think, more of as a decorative blade, but that was what was available. And as soon as I got this blade, it was like a whole different universe dealing with it. It wanted to cut. It fell right into the place. And there is a relationship with it. The bow, the sai, the tanfa, the nunchakus, those are all weapons, like a kitchen knife is an instrument. You use it for cutting, and even a well-made blade, a well-made kitchen knife will feel very natural and will do its work really well, but it's not a partner, a teacher, or in any sense, a being. It's a thing. The sword becomes more of a being and more of those things, a teacher, a partner. The boken, the wooden sword, does not have that same quality. You can practice the same moves, and you do, because again, you have to learn all of those movements and techniques before it's safe to use that live blade. But it's still not that extension of you. It's not this, there's a totally different feeling. Sadly, there's nobody now that teaches it. It's just the four of us that practice it. But that is the tradition.
Thank you. That was what I wanted to see if you could share. I'd like to share that the last time that I used my sharp sword when we were out in the park practicing together, I had the experience of it being weightless. It's definitely heavy. It's heavier than my boken, my wooden sword. But as I was working with it, it floated. I could feel that I had it in my hand, but it just moved without any weight. It was a beautiful experience.
Yeah, that relates in some ways to what Henry was talking about in that kata and to what I've been talking about with all of this. You can't make that happen. And on a day that it happens, you can kind of guarantee you're going to have 2 or 3 days of it going really badly because you're going to try to make it happen. It's very tempting. Just like having a great meditation, the next time you go to sit, oh, it's going to, you know, and then it's like three. But when everything is right, the kata happens. And you're just a still point within it. When everything is right, the sword moves itself. That's got to be where all those fairy tales about a sword that did the fighting for the peasant boy who picks it up or whoever came from. Even the bow, and which is a 6-foot quarterstaff, or the other weapons that are not mystical in this sense. There's a moment when you swing that thing around and it has no weight. It wasn't me swinging it. It just did it. The sword sharpens that and points it up and brings it out. But for me, all of these different things come together. And what I had in the sword or in the Tai Chi kata come out in the sparring. Because when it's ideal, when it's right, when it's where it needs to be, it's not me sparring you, it's us dancing together.
I think part of what you're pointing to is it's a relationship.
It's a relationship. Sensei Harp one time, I was grooving on it. I'm sure there were several people scratching their heads, but in a sparring class, and now you really need to love your partner. Yes. You know, he never took the other person as somebody he had to prove himself against. First of all, of course, yeah. But secondly, that was just the way he did it. And that was what made him so good.
Especially with an instrument like the sword that has the life to it, as you described it. The sword also informs you. It has to. And I think even if you were to fall in love with your bow, the quarterstaff.
No, it wouldn't be the same, no.
I'm not sure about that because I think it's all a relationship. Some lend themselves more to it than others. I understand that and I believe that. But I think when you fall in love with something, you also give it life.
Yes, yes.
So just as the swordsmith is giving life to the sword, mm-hmm. and then the sword add something, again, it sounds woo, but part of the life comes from the relationship, and it's a two-way street.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We were talking earlier, women have brought something to the martial arts. The martial arts have brought something to women. Mm-hmm. And a microcosm of that is the sword brought something alive in you and Kathleen. It didn't for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't even got that close to it. But you're also giving life to the sword. And Your sword is probably different now because you have been with it than before you were with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it's pretty mystical, but I think it's true. And I think that's something to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention and share with everyone here that I started the Kenjutsu art, the fighting art, after I got my black belt. And it was like Groundhog Day for me. Every time I went to class, I didn't remember anything. I didn't remember the terms. My teacher would bark at me and say, "Taught you this last week. Why don't you know it?" And it was just like I couldn't learn. And I had a hiatus in my martial arts career where I was gone for several years. And when I came back, I began to learn this art again. And the difference was that my instructor was a woman.
Yeah.
I was able to learn it. I earned my black belt in Kenjutsu. And there you go.
I think we bring some different features to teaching. But also, one of the cool things about the martial arts is every time you think you're there, you have to start, you're starting over at something, especially at a school where there were five arts being taught. You know, you get your green belt. I'm a hotshot. I now know karate. Oh, welcome to the bow, the 6-foot quarterstaff. Welcome to the nunchaku. And the green belt bruise is a thing because until you get good, you're more dangerous to yourself than anything else with those suckers. You get to brown belt. Okay, now I'm there. Oh, welcome to the side, this whole new thing. Welcome to these really long and complicated katas that have bits of everything else so you can get really confused. I've got my black belt. Welcome to Aiki. Let's start all over again. Welcome to the sword. So there's and within each art that you practice, there's also, I'm sparring, I'm a hotshot. Oh, this guy just beat me. There's always going to be somebody stronger, better, faster than you somewhere. There's always going to be something new you learn where you have to go right back to being a beginner again. So you do learn a certain amount of humility, which again, isn't making light of yourself. It's being detached from that ego, that I that always has to be coddled.
It's also part of what leads to the spirituality of the martial arts, because spirituality, again, to compartmentalize it for the sake of discussion, it's always a movement onward.
Yeah.
You never achieve the ultimate as long as you're alive, and probably after you're dead either. So you reach a stage and then it introduces you to another, or you have an experience like you had that opens the door, but you don't stop. It's a continual movement forward. Mm-hmm. There's a comment from Joyce and then a question from Eric. So from Joyce, it sounds like the sword is part of the spirit that we're all part of. It sounds like our mind is what keeps the spirit from working through the sword, making it feel like it's got its own life.
I would say the ego part of the mind. If you're in the zone, if you're in that moment of unknowing, whatever you want to call it, mind is fine. It's when the ego, when I start assessing, attaching a value to what happens, that's very Zen. That's very Buddhist. It's very Christian. The practice of mindfulness was practiced by the ancient desert fathers. They called it nepsis. And it was the same thing, knowing, you know. So, yeah.
Thank you. Eric, you get the last question.
A sword has a very sounding different quality than many other of the instruments that are used in combat or the practice discipline that any of these disciplines were originally designed for. And you were carrying a sword that was someone else's sword from before, and perhaps a military person, maybe ceremonially, but knowing some of the Japanese, they are pretty serious about things like a sword. So did you pick up any of the maleness of the guy that surrendered his sword once it became your sword, or just was back to clean, didn't need smudging, didn't need anything unusual to make it yours?
First of all, the sword had apparently, Sensei Harp and one of the other black belts got it for me at a gun show long time ago. So it had probably sat on somebody's shelf. It wasn't in its original fittings. It had World War II fittings, which I had removed and changed out just because I wasn't comfortable with the military fittings. But, you know, there had been a hiatus. So I didn't perceive anything like that stored in it. I did have it blessed. Partly because if you have an antique sword or an old sword, let me rephrase that, I don't know that it's an antique, they sometimes had rather unpleasant ways of testing the blade involving convicts, and I don't want to go there. So I had it blessed. I did not perceive any of that kind of energy. I have heard of people who, not at the dojo, who had swords that came from other, that's what, when I said that some swords or swordsmiths were considered bad luck, there have been swords that people really had a negative sense of. I just did not with mine. Right. But blessing was definitely something. And, you know, I would do that with any such sword that I got, especially if it wasn't newly forged. But that also, again, sets it apart. I just want to say one thing, and it goes back to something that Joyce and Henry both talked about with the martial arts. And I think this is true of any practice, especially a mind-body practice, yoga, Tai Chi. There's a point when you know everything on the external level. Nobody has something new to teach you on the external level in terms of techniques at the moment within that art. But there's always the invitation to go deeper. And that invitation actually starts when you learn the first kata. I can remember there's a movement that was really difficult for me to master in the very first kata. And I spent a lot of time just walking in circles around the dojo floor, doing that move over and over again and trying to feel it. And then later I got interested in, okay, what muscle is initiating that? You know what? So there's always the invitation to go deeper. I found that the people who disliked kata tended to be people who in this particular discipline weren't necessarily interested in going deeper that way. They were more goal-directed. And once you get your black belt, in the old, before they had the belt system, the term for what we call first degree black belt was oku iri, entrance to secrets. And one of the things you discover is there really are no secrets. But having discovered, and I'll go into that some other time, but that invitation to go deeper is always there. First, you have to do the grunt work. You get the basics, you get the surface stuff. And then there's always the invitation to go deeper. And that's the point, whether it's a martial art or painting or pottery or yoga or meditation, that's the place where you have the choice to quit or stay there or go deeper. And it may just be that this isn't the vehicle for you to do that in, you know?
Right.
So
there are two things. Are there any YouTubes of Sensei Harp? I've seen a video of him cutting the apple. I don't know where I saw that.
I will have to look and see.
And also, I remember seeing a video of him doing the sword kata that we've talked about. I know I've seen it someplace, but it's not.
That's
it's not
probably where you saw
accessible
it.
Accessible like YouTube, it's private.
Right.
Okay. If you can help that, and maybe for the people that are on the video. But it's one of the most amazing things that I've seen, and it speaks to a lot of what we've been talking about: the elegance, the beauty, the power—all in this 5 seconds or less.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things that were mentioned in passing that I wanted to highlight. One is, as I hope you've gathered, Sensei Harp was a master and recognized martial artist. Started off in an organized program, but he added his own to it. So remember the story that Sensei Margo shared with us about his developing what he called the Tai Chi Kata. That came from him. It wasn't Tai Chi, but a master said, it's beautiful. It's really powerful. For a lot of us, that would be, well, you know, it's not recognized. It's not an authentic form. What Margo shared is authenticity comes from the experience. It was an authentic experience. And a lot of us, or in our culture, get so caught up in it has to be an authentic form of Sufism. It has to be an authentic form of, I grew up Roman Catholic. It has to be exactly the way it was taught. And if you deviate from that, then you're a heretic and da, 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 da. And, you know, Margo had mentioned in passing organized religion. And What we experienced in this dojo was something that had the elements of something that was recognized internationally, but it had a different flavor to it. The flavor of this master sensei who knew that it was authentic because of the foundation and what he brought to it, validated by other witnesses, including his students. Mm-hmm. So when you look at some of his students, like Sensei Margo, don't tell me it's not authentic. You may not be able to say it's absolutely Ishinryu karate. The experience of martial arts and being the essence of martial arts is there. So Michael Mead, who's a self-made mythologist, he was learning African drumming. And he said he would try to get it exactly right. And he would get all upset when he would make a mistake. And his teacher said, no, the mistake is what let something new come in. And then it freed him. And then it was like, oh, you know, in a little, very amateurish way, I'm a guitar player. I didn't do anything professionally. I'm not very good. I have a lot of holes in my music theory. My technique isn't the greatest. And suddenly I realized, well, I'm trying to play this like the Beatles and I can't do it. Why don't I just do what I can do? And somebody came up to me and said, whatever you're doing, I just want you to know that it's really moving for me.
Yeah.
That's
authenticity.
It.
Yeah.
So the difference between somebody stamps it as a recognized form of anything and it must be this way, do not deviate, versus, yeah, you do your grunt work, you learn something, but then if you leave yourself out of it, what does it become? Mm-hmm. We're back to it's a relationship. Everything is a relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think what we learned in this form that we called harp karate, which is not internationally recognized, it's a form of Ishinryu, but it isn't Ishinryu karate. If you went to this part I do know, you go to an authorized Ishinryu school, the stance is different, the katas are different. Harp, Sensei Harp, modified it based on something that was coming through him. Does that make it not authentic? You may not be able to commercially say, this is Ishinryu karate. It is karate, and it's an authentic experience. Same goes for spirituality. So I think when we get into this in February about Sensei Margo's experience of a woman in the Catholic Church and look at her resume, what she's added in her own way, Dzogchen, Zen, Celtic spirituality. I'm not going to miss February in talking about this with her, but I really wanted to highlight that partly as a segue, but I think that's a lot of what we've been talking about. If you don't let yourself feel it and be it and let it take you, then potentially you're really missing something.
So, can I add one thing to that, Henry? Yes. Ironically, the originator of Ishinryu karate, Tatsuo Shimabuku, was somewhat vilified by many people on Okinawa because he did exactly that. He took things from all these other different arts and put them together. Right. When you think about it, organized religion most of the times is the result of somebody having an experience and then finding ways to share it. And then eventually that becomes set in stone. This is how we do it.
Right.
And so that ossification process is very dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
The test is, you know, Sunbury always used to say, does your spirituality grow corn?
Yes. So one of the ways that we say this in the Sufi tradition, which is if you want to have an idea about the authenticity of the teacher, look at the students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same. You want to have an idea of the authenticity of Sensei Harp's approach to martial arts, look at Sensei Margo. You may not want to look at me, but you can look at Sensei Margo. This has been a joy. I hope you had as much fun as I did. It's really
thank you. It's been great for me. I hope it's been helpful for others here.
So February 19th, we'll talk about the role of women in the Christian ministry. Please come back. So thank you all.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.